Please don't be mad at me.
We're not mad, Jerome says. Just surprised. Shocked is more like it, Hodges thinks.
I spent the morning in my room, browsing the local IT community. But it's like we thought. There are hundreds of them. Mom and Uncle Henry went out to talk to people. About Janie, I think. I guess there'll have to be another funeral. But I hate to think about what will be in the coffin. It just makes me cry and cry.
And yes, big tears are rolling down her cheeks. Jerome puts an arm around her. She gives him a shy, grateful glance.
Sometimes it's hard for me to think when my mother is around. It's like she puts interference in my head. I guess that makes me sound crazy.
Not to me, Jerome says. I feel the same way about my sister, especially when she plays her damn boy band CDs.
When they were gone and the house was quiet, I got an idea. I went back down to Olivia's computer and looked at her email.
Jerome slaps his forehead. Shit! I never even thought of checking her mail.
Don't worry, there wasn't any. She had three accounts. Macmail, Gmail, and AOL. But all three folders were empty. Maybe she deleted them herself, but I don't think so, because...
Because her desktop and hard drive were full of stuff, Jerome says.
That's right. She has The Bridge on the River Kwai in her iTunes. I've never seen that. I might check it out if I get a chance.
Hodges glances toward Discount Electronics. With the sun glaring on the windows, it's impossible to tell if anyone's watching him. He feels exposed out here like a bug on a rock. Let's take a little stroll, he says, and leads them towards Savoy Shoes, Barnes & Noble, and Whitey's Happy Frogurt Shop. Jerome says, come on, Holly, give, you're driving me crazy here. That makes her smile, which makes her look older, more her age. And once they're away from the big Discount Electronics show windows, Hodges feels better. It's obvious to him that Jerome is delighted with her, and he feels the same, more or less in spite of himself. But it's humbling to find he's been scooped by a Lexapro-dependent neurotic.
He forgot to take off his spook program, so I thought maybe he forgot to empty her junk mail as well, and I was right. She had like 4 dozen emails from Discount Electronics. Some of them were sales notices, like the one they're having now, although I bet the only DVDs they have left aren't much good. They're probably Korean or something, and some of them were coupons for 20% off. She also had coupons for 30% off. The 30% coupons were for her next Cyber Patrol outcall. She shrugs. And here I am.
Jerome stares at her. That's all it took? Just a peek into her junk mail folder? Don't be so surprised, Hodges says. All it took to catch the Son of Sam was a parking ticket.
I walked around back while I was waiting for you, Holly says. Their webpage says there are only 3 ITs in the Cyber Patrol, and there are 3 of those green beetles back there, so I guess the guy is working today. Are you going to arrest him, Mr. Hodges?
She's biting her lips again.
What if he fights? I don't want you to get hurt.
Hodges is thinking hard. 3 computer techs in the Cyber Patrol. Frobisher, Hartsfield, and Linkletter, the skinny blonde woman. He's almost positive it will turn out to be Frobisher or Hartsfield, and whichever one it is won't be prepared to see Kermit Frog 19 walking through the door. Even if Mr. Mercedes doesn't run, he won't be able to hide the initial shock of recognition. I'm going in. You two are staying here.
Going in with no backup? Jerome asks.
Gee, Bill, I don't think that's very smart. I'll be all right. I've got the element of surprise going for me, but if I'm not back out in 10 minutes, call 911, got it?
Yes.
Hodges points at Holly. You stay close to Jerome. No more lone wolf investigations. I should talk, he thinks. She nods humbly, and Hodges walks away before they can engage him in further discussion. As he approaches the doors of Discount Electronics, he unbuttons his sport coat. The weight of his father's gun against his rib cage is comforting. 7. As they watch Hodges enter the electronics store, a question occurs to Jerome. Holly, how did you get here? Taxi? She shakes her head and points into the parking lot. There, parked 3 rows back from Jerome's Wrangler, is a gray Mercedes sedan.
It was in the garage.
She notes Jerome's slack-jawed amazement and immediately becomes defensive.
I can drive, you know. I have a valid driver's license. I've never had an accident, and I have safe driver's insurance from Allstate. Do you know that the man who does the Allstate ads on TV used to be the president on 24?
That's the car. She frowns, puzzled.
What's the big deal, Jerome? It was in the garage, and the keys were in a basket in the front hall. So what's the big fat deal?
The dents are gone, he notes. The headlights and windshield have been replaced. It looks as good as new. You'd never know it was used to kill people.
Jerome, do you think Olivia would mind?
No, he says. Probably not. He is imagining that grill covered with blood, pieces of shredded cloth dangling from it.
It wouldn't start at first. The battery was dead, but she had one of those portable jump stations, and I knew how to use it because my father had one. Jerome, if Mr. Hodges doesn't make an arrest, could we walk down to the Frogert place?
He barely hears her. He's still staring at the Mercedes. They returned it to her, he thinks. Well, of course they did. It was her property, after all. She even got the damage repaired. But he'd be willing to bet she never drove it again. If there were spooks, real ones, they'd be in there, probably screaming.
Jerome? Earth to Jerome.
Huh?
If everything turns out okay, let's get Frogert. I was sitting in the sun waiting for you guys, and I'm awfully hot. I'll treat. I'd really like ice cream, but...
He doesn't hear the rest. He's thinking, ice cream. The click in his head is so loud he actually winces. And all at once he knows why one of the cyber patrol faces on Hodges' computer looked familiar to him. The strength goes out of his legs, and he leans against one of the walkway support posts to keep from falling. Oh, my God, he says.
What's wrong?
She shakes his arm, chewing her lips frantically.
What's wrong? Are you sick, Jerome?
But at first he can only say it again. Oh, my God. 8. Hodges thinks that the Birch Hill Mall Discount Electronics looks like an enterprise with about 3 months to live. Many of the shelves are empty, and the stock that's left has a disconsolate, neglected look. Almost all of the browsers are in the home entertainment department, where fluorescent pink signs proclaim, Wow! DVD blowout! All discs, 50% off! Even Blu-ray! Although there are 10 checkout lines, only 3 are open, staffed by women in blue dusters with the yellow DE logo on them. 2 of these women are looking out the window. The third is reading Twilight. A couple of other employees are wandering the aisles doing a lot of nothing much. Hodges doesn't want any of them, but he sees 2 of the 3 he does want. Anthony Frobisher, he of the John Lennon specs, is talking to a customer who has a shopping basket full of discounted DVDs in one hand and a clutch of coupons in the other. Frobisher's tie suggests that he might be the store manager as well as a cyber patrolman. The narrow-faced girl with the dirty blonde hair is at the back of the store seated at a computer. There's a cigarette parked behind one ear. Hodges strolls up the center aisle of the DVD blowout. Frobisher looks at him and raises a finger to say, Be with you soon. Hodges smiles and gives him a little, I'm okay, wave. Frobisher returns to the customer with the coupons. No recognition there. Hodges walks on to the back of the store. The dirty blonde looks up at him, then back at the screen of the computer she's using. No recognition from her either. She's not wearing a discount electronics shirt. Her says, When I want my opinion, I'll give it to you. He sees she's playing an updated version of Pitfall, a cruder version of which fascinated his daughter Allison a quarter of a century before. Everything that goes around comes around, Hodges thinks. A Zen concept for sure.
Unless you've got a computer question, talk to Tones. She says, I only do crunchers.
Tones would be Anthony Frobisher?
Yeah, Mr. Spiffy in the time.
You'd be Freddy Linklater of the Cyber Patrol.
Yeah.
She pauses Pitfall Harry in mid-jump over a coiled snake in order to give him a closer inspection. What she sees is Hodges' police ID with his thumb strategically placed to hide its year of expiration.
Ooh,
she says, and holds out her hands with the twig-thin wrists together.
I'm a bad, bad girl, and handcuffs are what I deserve. Whip me, beat me, make me write bad checks.
Hodges gives a brief smile and tucks his ID away. Isn't Brady Hartsfield the third member of your happy band? I don't see him.
Out with the flu. He says. Want my best guess?
Hit me.
I think maybe he finally had to put dear old Mom in rehab. He says she drinks and he has to take care of her most of the time, which is probably why he's never had a GF. You know what that is, right?
I'm pretty sure, yeah. She examines him with bright and mordant interest.
Is Brady in trouble? I wouldn't be surprised. He's a little on the, you know, peculiar side.
I just need to speak to him. Anthony Frobisher, Tones, joins them.
May I help you, sir?
It's 5-0, Freddie says. She gives Frobisher a wide smile that exposes small teeth badly in need of cleaning.
He found out about the meth lab in the back.
Can it, Freddie?
She makes an extravagant lip-zipping gesture, finishing with the twist of an invisible key, but doesn't go back to her game. In Hodges' pocket, his cell phone rings. He silences it with his thumb.
I'm Detective Bill Hodges, Mr. Frobisher. I have a few questions for Brady Hartsfield.
He's out with the flu. What did he do?
Tones is a poet and don't know it, Freddie Linklater observes, although his feet show it, because they're long felt.
Shut up, Freddie, for the last time.
Can I have his address, please?
Of course, I'll get it for you.
Can I unshut for a minute?
Freddie asks. Hodges nods. She punches a key on her computer. Pitfall Harry is replaced by a spreadsheet headed Store Personnel.
Presto, she says. 49 Elm Street. That's on the...
North side, yeah, Hodges says. Thank you both, you've been very helpful.
As he leaves, Freddie Linklater calls after him. It's something with his mom, bet you anything. He's freaky about her.
9. Hodges has no more than stepped out into the bright sunshine when Jerome almost tackles him. Holly lurks just behind. She stopped biting her lips and gone to her fingernails, which looked badly abused.
I called you, Jerome says. Why didn't you pick up?
I was asking questions. What's got you all wide-eyed?
Is Hartsfield in there?
Hodges is too surprised to reply.
Oh, it's him. Jerome says, gotta be. You were right about him watching you, and I know how. It's like that Hawthorne story about the purloined letter. Hide in plain sight.
Holly stops munching her fingernails long enough to say,
Poe wrote that story. Don't they teach your kids anything?
Hodges says, slow down, Jerome. Jerome takes a deep breath.
He's got 2 jobs, Bill. 2. He must only work here until mid-afternoon or something. After that, he works for Loeb's.
Loeb's? Is that the...
Yeah, the ice cream company. He drives the Mr. Tasty truck. The one with the bells. I've bought stuff from him. My sister has too. All the kids do. He's on our side of town a lot. Brady Hartsfield is the ice cream man.
Hodges realizes he's heard those cheerful tinkling bells more than a lot lately. In the spring of his depression, crashed out in his lazy boy watching afternoon TV and sometimes playing with the gun now riding against his ribs, it seems he heard them every day. Heard them and ignored them, because only kids pay actual attention to the ice cream man. Except some deeper part of his mind didn't completely ignore them. It was the deep part that kept coming back to Bowfinger in his satiric comment about Mrs. Melbourne. She thinks they walk among us, Mr. Bowfinger said. But it hadn't been space aliens Mrs. Melbourne had been concerned about on the day Hodges had done his canvas. It had been black SUVs and chiropractors and the people on Hanover Street who played loud music late at night. Also, the Mr. Tasty Man.
That one looks suspicious, she had said. This spring, it seems like he's always around, she had said.
A terrible question surfaces in his mind, like one of the snakes always lying in wait for Pitfall Harry. If he had paid attention to Mrs. Melbourne instead of dismissing her as a harmless crank the way he and Pete dismissed Olivia Trelawney, would Janie still be alive? He doesn't think so, but he's never going to know for sure, and he has an idea that the question will haunt a great many sleepless nights in the weeks and months to come. Maybe the years. He looks out at the parking lot.
And there he sees a ghost. A gray one. He turns back to Jerome and Holly, now standing side by side, and doesn't even have to ask.
Yeah, Jerome says. Holly drove it here.
The registration and the sticker decal on the license plate are both a tiny bit expired,
Holly says.
Please don't be mad at me, okay? I had to come. I wanted to help, but I knew if I just called you, you'd say no.
I'm not mad, Hodges says. In fact, he doesn't know what he is. He feels like he's entered a dream world where all the clocks run backward.
What do we do now? Jerome asks.
Call the cops?
But Hodges is still not ready to let go. The young man in the picture may have a cauldron of crazy boiling away behind his bland face, but Hodges has met his share of psychopaths and knows that when they're taken by surprise, most collapse like puffballs. They're only dangerous to the unarmed and unsuspecting, like the broke folks waiting to apply for jobs on that April morning in 2009. Lest you and I take a ride to Mr. Hartsfield's place of residence, Hodges says, and let's go in that. He points to the gray Mercedes.
But if he sees us pull up, won't he recognize it?
Hodges smiles a shark-like smile Jerome Robinson has never seen before. I certainly hope so. He holds out his hand. May I have the key, Holly?
Her abused lips tighten.
Yes, but I'm going.
No way, Hodges says. Too dangerous.
If it's too dangerous for me, it's too dangerous for you.
She won't look directly at him, and her eyes keep skipping past his face, but her voice is firm.
You can make me stay, but if you do, I'll call the police and give them Brady Hartsfield's address just as soon as you're gone.
You don't have it, Hodges says. This sounds feeble even to him. Holly doesn't reply, which is a form of courtesy. She won't even need to go inside Discount Electronics and ask the dirty blonde. Now that they have the name, she can probably suss out the Hartsfield address from her devilish iPad. Fuck. All right, you can come. But I drive, and when we get there, you and Jerome are going to stay in the car. Do you have a problem with that?
No, Mr. Hodges.
This time her eyes go to his face and stay there for 3 whole seconds. It might be a step forward. With Holly, he thinks, who knows?
10. Because of drastic budget cuts that kicked in the previous year, most city patrol cars are solo rides. This isn't the case in Lowtown. In Lowtown, every shop holds a deuce. The ideal deuce containing at least one person of color, because in Lowtown, the minorities are the majority. At just past noon on June 3rd, officers Laverty and Rosario are cruising Lowbriar Avenue, about half a mile beyond the overpass where Bill Hodges once stopped a couple of trolls from robbing a shorty. Laverty is white, Rosario is Latina. Because their shop is CPC 54, they are known in the department as Tootie and Muldoon, after the cops in an ancient sitcom called Car 54, Where Are You? Amaryllis Rosario sometimes amuses her fellow blue knights at roll call by saying, "Uh-oh, Tootie, I got an idea." It sounds extremely cute in her Dominican accent and always gets a laugh. On patrol, however, she's Ms. taking care of business. They both are. In Lowtown, you have to be.
The corner boys remind me of the Blue Angels in this air show I saw once, she says now.
Yeah?
They see us coming. They peel off like they're in formation. Look, there goes another one.
As they approach the intersection of Lowbriar and Strike, a kid in a Cleveland Cavaliers warm-up jacket, oversized and totally superfluous on this day, suddenly decamps from the corner where he's been jiving around and heads down Strike at a trot. He looks about 13.
Maybe he just remembered it's a school day, Laverty says.
Rosario laughs.
As if, ese.
Now they are approaching the corner of Lowbriar and Martin Luther King Avenue. MLK is the ghetto's other large thoroughfare, and this time half a dozen corner boys decide they have business elsewhere.
That's formation flying, all right, Laverty says. He laughs, although it's not really funny.
Listen, where do you want to eat?
Let's see if that wagon's on Randolph, she says. I'm in a taco state of mind.
Señor Taco it is, he says, but lay off the beans, okay? We've got another 4 hours in this.
Huh. Check it, Rosie. That's weird. Up ahead, a man is coming out of a storefront with a long flower box. It's weird because the storefront isn't a florist's. It's King Virtue Pawn and Loan. It's also weird because the man looks Caucasian and they are now in the blackest part of Lowtown. He's approaching a dirty white econoline van that's standing on a yellow curb, a $20 fine. Laverty and Rosario are hungry, though. They've got their faces fixed for tacos with that nice hot picante sauce Señor Taco keeps on the counter, and they might have let it go. Probably would have. But with David Berkowitz, it was a parking ticket. With Ted Bundy, it was a busted taillight. Today, a florist's box with badly folded flaps is all it takes to change the world. As the guy fumbles for the keys to his old van, not even Emperor Ming of Mongo would leave his vehicle unlocked in Lowtown, the box tilts downward. The end comes open, and something slides partway out. The guy catches it and shoves it back in before it can fall into the street. But Jason Laverty spent 2 tours in Iraq, and he knows an RPG launcher when he sees it. He flips on the blues and hooks in behind the guy, who looks around with a startled expression. "Sidearm," he snaps at his partner. "Get it out." They fly out the doors, double-fisted Glocks pointing at the sky. "Drop the box, sir," Laverty shouts. "Drop the box and put your hands on the van. Lean forward. Do it now." For a moment, the guy, he's about 40, olive-skinned, round-shouldered, hugs the florist's box tighter against his chest like a baby. But when Rosie Rosario lowers her gun, points it at his chest, he drops the box. It splits wide open and reveals what Laverty tentatively identifies as a Russian-made Hashim anti-tank grenade launcher. "Holy shit," Rosario says, and then, Tootie, I got an id-"
"Officers, lower your weapons."
Laverty keeps his focus on grenade launcher guy, but Rosario turns and sees a gray-haired cock in a blue jacket. He's wearing an earpiece and has his own Glock. Before she can ask him anything, the street is full of men in blue jackets, all running for King Virtue Pawn and Loan. One is carrying a Stinger battering ram, the kind cops call a baby doorbuster. She sees ATF on the backs of the jackets, and all at once she has that unmistakable "I stepped in shit" feeling.
"Officers, lower your weapons."
"Agent James Kaczynski, ATF. Laverty says, "Maybe you'd like one of us to cuff him first, just asking." ATF agents are piling into the pawn shop like Christmas shoppers into Walmart on Black Friday. A crowd is gathering across the street, as yet too stunned by the size of the strike force to start casting aspersions, or stones for that matter. Kaczynski sighs. "You may as well," he says. "The horse has left the barn." "We didn't know you had anything going," Laverty says. Meanwhile, grenade launcher guy already has his hands off the van and behind him with the wrists pressed together. It's pretty clear this isn't his first rodeo. "He was unlocking his van, and I saw that poking out of the end of the box. What was I supposed to do?" "What you did, of course." From inside the pawn shop, there comes the sound of breaking glass, shouts, and then the boom of the doorbuster being put to work. "Tell you what, now that you're here, why don't you throw Mr. Cavelli there in the back of your car and come on inside? See what we've got." While Laverty and Rosario are escorting their prisoner to the cruiser, Kaczynski notes the number. "So," he says, "which one of you is Tootie and which one is Muldoon?" 11. As the ATF strike force led by Agent Kaczynski begins its inventory of the cavernous storage area behind King Virtue Pawn and Loan's humble facade, a gray Mercedes sedan is pulling to the curb in front of 49 Elm Street. Hodges is behind the wheel. Today Holly is riding shotgun, because she claims, with at least some logic, the car is more hers than theirs.
"Someone is home," she points out. "There's a very badly maintained Honda Civic in the driveway."
Hodges notes the shuffling approach of an old man from the house directly across the street. "I will now speak with Mr. Concerned Citizen. You two will keep your mouths shut." He rolls down his window. "Help you, sir?"
"I thought maybe I could help you,"
the old guy says. His bright eyes are busy inventorying Hodges and his passengers. Also the car, which doesn't surprise Hodges. It's a mighty fine car.
"If you're looking for Brady, you're out of luck. That in the driveway is Mrs. Hartsfield's car. Haven't seen it move in weeks. Not sure it even runs anymore. Maybe Mrs. Hartsfield went off with him because I haven't seen her today. Usually I do when she toddles out to get her post."
He points to the mailbox beside the door of 49.
"She likes the catalogs. Most women do."
He extends a knuckly hand.
"Hank Beeson."
Hodges shakes it briefly, then flashes his ID, careful to keep his thumb over the expiration date. Good to meet you, Mr. Beeson. I'm Detective Bill Hodges. Can you tell me what kind of car Mr. Hartsfield drives? Make and model?
It's a brown Subaru. Can't help you with the model of the year. All those rice burners look the same to me.
Uh-huh. Have to ask you to go back to your house now, sir. We may come by to ask you a few questions later.
Did Brady do something wrong?
Just a routine call, Hodges says. Going back to your house, please. Instead of doing that, Beeson bends lower for a look at Jerome.
Aren't you kinda young to be on the cops?
I'm a trainee, Jerome says. Better do as Detective Hodges says, sir.
I'm going.
But he gives the trio another stem to stern once over first.
Since when do city cops drive around in Mercedes-Benzes?
Hodges has no answer for that, but Holly does.
It's a RICO car. RICO stands for Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations. We take their stuff. We can use it any way we want because we're the police.
Well, yeah. Sure. Stands to reason.
Beeson looks partly satisfied and partly mystified. But he goes back to his house where he soon appears to them again, this time looking out a front window. RICO is the feds, Hodges says mildly. Holly tips her head fractionally toward their observer, and there's a faint smile on her hard-used lips.
Do you think he knows that?
When neither of them answers, she becomes businesslike.
What do we do now?
If Hartsfield's in there, I'm going to make a citizen's arrest. If he's not, but his mother is, I'm going to interview her. You two are going to stay in the car.
I don't know if that's a good idea, Jerome says, but by the expression on his face, Hodges can see it in the rearview mirror. He knows this objection will be overruled.
It's the only one I have, Hodges says. He gets out of the car. Before he can close the door, Holly leans toward him and says,
There's no one home.
He doesn't say anything, but she nods as if he had.
Can't you feel it?
Actually, he can.
12. Hodges walks up the driveway, noting the drawn drapes in the big front window. He looks briefly in the Honda and sees nothing worth noting. He tries the passenger door. It opens. The air inside is hot and stale with a faintly boozy smell. He shuts the door, climbs the porch steps, and rings the doorbell. He hears it cling-clong inside the house. Nobody comes. He tries it again, then knocks. Nobody comes. He hammers with the side of his fist, very aware that Mr. Beeson from across the street is taking all this in. Nobody comes. He strolls to the garage and peers through one of the windows in the overhead door. A few tools, a mini-fridge, not much else. He takes out his cell phone and calls Jerome. This block of Elm Street is very still, and he can hear, faintly, the AC-DC ringtone as the call goes through. He sees Jerome answer. Have Holly jump on her iPad and check the city tax records for the owner's name at 49 Elm. Can she do that? He hears Jerome asking Holly.
She says she'll see what she can do.
Good. I'm going around back. Stay on the line. I'll check in with you at roughly 30-second intervals. If more than a minute goes by without hearing from me, call 911.
You positive you want to do this, Bill?
Yes. Be sure Holly knows that getting the name isn't a big deal. I don't want her getting squirrely.
She's chill, Jerome says, already tapping away. Just make sure you stay in touch.
Count on it.
He walks between the garage and the house. The backyard is small but neatly kept. There's a circular bed of flowers in the middle. Hodges wonders who planted them, Mom or Sonny Boy. He mounts three wooden steps to the back stoop. There's an aluminum screen door with another door inside. The screen door is unlocked. The house door isn't. Jerome, checking in, all quiet. He peers through the glass and sees a kitchen. It's squared away. There are a few plates and glasses in the drainer by the sink. A neatly folded dish wiper hangs over the oven handle. There are two placemats on the table. No placemat for Papa Bear, which fits the profile he has fleshed out on his yellow legal pad. He knocks, then hammers. Nobody comes. Jerome, checking in, all quiet. He puts his phone down on the back stoop and takes out the flat leather case, glad he thought of it. Inside are his father's lockpicks, 3 silver rods with hooks of varying sizes at the ends. He selects the medium pick. A good choice. It slides in easily. He fiddles around, turning the pick first one way, then the other, feeling for the mechanism. He's just about to pause and check in with Jerome again when the pick catches. He twists, quick and hard, just as his father taught him, and there's a click as the locking button pops up on the kitchen side of the door. Meanwhile, his phone is squawking his name. He picks it up. Jerome? All quiet.
You had me worried, Jerome says. What are you doing?
Breaking and entering.
13. Hodges steps into the Hartsfield kitchen. The smell hits him at once. It's faint, but it's there. Holding his cell phone in his left hand and his father's .38 in the right, Hodges follows his nose first into the living room, empty, although the TV remote and scattering of catalogs on the coffee table makes him think that the couch is Mrs. Hartsfield's downstairs nest, and then up the stairs. The smell gets stronger as he goes. It's not a stench yet, but it's headed in that direction. There's a short upstairs hall with 1 door on the right and 2 on the left. He clears the right-hand room first. It's guest quarters where no guests have stayed for a long time. It's as sterile as an operating theater. He checks in with Jerome again before opening the first door on the left. This is where the smell is coming from. He takes a deep breath and enters fast, crouching until he's assured himself there's no one behind the door. He opens the closet. This door is the kind that folds on a center hinge and shoves back the clothes. No one. Jerome, checking in.
Is anyone there?
Well, sort of. The coverlid of the double bed has been pulled up over an unmistakable shape. Wait, 1. He looks under the bed and sees nothing but a pair of slippers, a pair of pink sneakers, a single white ankle sock, and a few dust kitties. He pulls the coverlet back, and there's Brady Hartsfield's mother. Her skin is waxy pale, with a faint green undertint. Her mouth hangs ajar. Her eyes, dusty and glazed, have settled in their sockets. He lifts an arm, flexes it slightly, lets it drop. Rigor has come and gone. Listen, Jerome. I've found Mrs. Hartsfield. She's dead.
Oh, my God.
Jerome's usually adult voice cracks on the last word.
What are you?
Wait, 1.
You already said that.
Hodges puts his phone on the night table and draws the coverlet down to Mrs. Hartsfield's feet. She's wearing blue silk pajamas. The shirt is stained with what appears to be vomit and some blood, but there's no visible bullet hole or stab wound. Her face is swollen, yet there are no ligature marks or bruises on her neck. The swelling is just the slow death march of decomposition. He pulls up her pajama top enough so he can see her belly. Like her face, it's slightly swollen, but he's betting that's gas. He leans close to her mouth, looks inside, and sees what he expected. Clotted goop on her tongue and in the gutters between her gums and her cheeks. He's guessing she got drunk, sicked up her last meal, and went out like a rock star. The blood could be from her throat, or an aggravated stomach ulcer. He picks up the phone and says, he might have poisoned her, but it's more likely she did it to herself.
Booze?
Probably. Without a post-mortem, there's no way to tell.
What do you want us to do?
Sit tight.
We still don't call the police?
Not yet.
Holly wants to talk to you.
There's a moment of dead air, then she's on the line, and clear as a bell. She sounds calm. Calmer than Jerome, actually.
Her name is Deborah Hartsfield, the kind of Deborah that ends in an H.
Good job. Give the phone back to Jerome. A second later, Jerome says,
I hope you know what you're doing.
I don't, he thinks as he checks the bathroom. I've lost my mind, and the only way to get it back is to let go of this. You know that. But he thinks of Janie giving him his new hat, his snappy private eye fedora, and knows he can't. Won't. The bathroom is clean. Or almost. There's some hair in the sink. Hodges sees it, but doesn't take note of it.
He's thinking of the crucial difference between accidental death and murder. Murder would be bad because killing close family members is all too often how a serious nutcase starts his final run. If it was an accident or suicide, there might still be time. Brady could be hunkered down somewhere trying to decide what to do next. Which is too close to what I'm doing, Hodges thinks. The last upstairs room is Brady's. The bed is unmade. The desk is piled helter-skelter with books, most of them science fiction. There's a Terminator poster on the wall, with Schwarzenegger wearing dark glasses and toting a futuristic elephant gun. I'll be back, Hodges thinks, looking at it. Jerome, checking in.
The guy from across the street is still scoping us. Holly thinks we should come inside.
Not yet.
When?
When I'm sure this place is clear. Brady has his own bathroom. It's as neat as a GI's footlocker on inspection day. Hodges gives it a cursory glance, then goes back downstairs. There's a small alcove off the living room with just enough space for a small desk. On it is a laptop. A purse hangs by its strap from the back of the chair. On the wall is a large framed photograph of the woman upstairs and a teenage version of Brady Hartsfield. They're standing on a beach somewhere with their arms around each other and their cheeks pressed together. They're wearing identical million-dollar smiles. It's more girlfriend-boyfriend than mother-son. Hodges looks with fascination upon Mr. Mercedes in his salad days. There's nothing in his face that suggests homicidal tendencies, but of course there almost never is. The resemblance between the two of them is faint, mostly in the shape of the noses and the color of the hair. She was a pretty woman, really just short of beautiful, but Hodges is willing to guess that Brady's father didn't have similar good looks. The boy in the photo seems ordinary. A kid you'd pass on the street without a second glance. That's probably the way he likes it, Hodges thinks. The invisible man. He goes back into the kitchen and this time sees a door beside the stove. He opens it and looks at steep stairs descending into darkness. Aware that he makes a perfect silhouette for anyone who might be down there, Hodges moves to one side while he feels for the light switch. He finds it and steps into the doorway again with the gun leveled. He sees a work table. Beyond it, a waist-high shelf runs the length of the room. On it is a line of computers. It makes him think of Mission Control at Cape Canaveral. Jerome, checking in. Without waiting for an answer, he goes down with the gun in one hand and his phone in the other, perfectly aware of what a grotesque perversion of all established police procedure this is. What if Brady is under the stairs with his own gun, ready to shoot Hodges' feet off at the ankles? Or suppose he set up a booby trap? He can do it. This Hodges now knows all too well. He strikes no tripwire, and the basement is empty. There's a storage closet, the door standing open, but nothing is stored there. He sees only empty shelves. In one corner is a litter of shoeboxes. They also appear to be empty. The message, Hodges thinks, is Brady either killed his mother or came home and found her dead. Either way, he then decamped. If he did have explosives, they were on those closet shelves, possibly in the shoeboxes, and he took them along. Hodges goes upstairs. It's time to bring in his new partners. He doesn't want to drag them in deeper than they already are, but there are those computers downstairs. He knows jack shit about computers. Come around to the back, he says. The kitchen door is open.
14. Holly steps in, sniffs, and says, "Oof. Is that Deborah Hartsfield?"
"Yes. Try not to think about it. Come downstairs, you guys. I want you to look at something."
In the basement, Jerome runs a hand over the work table. Whatever else he is, he's Mr. Awesomely Neat. "Are you going to call the police, Mr. Hodges?"
Holly is biting her lips again.
"You probably are, and I can't stop you, but my mother is going to be so mad at me. Also, it doesn't seem fair since we're the ones who found out who he is."
"I haven't decided what I'm going to do," Hodges says, although she's right. It doesn't seem fair at all. "But I'd sure like to know what's on those computers. That might help me make up my mind.
He won't be like Olivia, Holly says. He'll have a good password.
Jerome picks one of the computers at random. It happens to be Brady's number 6, not much on that one, and pushes the recess button on the back of the monitor. It's a Mac, but there's no chime. Brady hates that cheery chime and has turned it off on all his computers. Number 6 flashes gray, and the boot-up worry circle starts going round and round. After 5 seconds or so, gray turns to blue. This should be the password screen, even Hodges knows that. But instead, a large 20 appears on the screen. Then, 19, 18, and 17. He and Jerome stare at it in perplexity.
No, no!
Holly nearly screams it. Turn it off! When neither of them moves immediately, she darts forward and pushes the power button behind the monitor again, holding it down until the screen goes dark.
Then she lets out a breath and actually smiles. Jeepers! That was a close one.
What are you thinking, Hodges asks. That they're wired up to explode or something?
Maybe they only lock up, Holly says. But I bet it's a suicide program. If the countdown gets to zero, that kind of program scrubs the data. All the data. Maybe just in the one that's on, but in all of them if they're wired together, which they probably are.
So how do you stop it? Jerome asks. Keyboard command?
Maybe that. Maybe voice act.
Voice what? Hodges asks. Voice activated command, Jerome tells him. Brady says milk duds or underwear and the countdown stops. Holly giggles through her fingers, then gives Jerome a timid push on the shoulder.
You're silly,
she says. 15. They sit at the kitchen table with the back door open to let in fresh air. Hodges has an elbow on one of the placemats and his brow cupped in his palm. Jerome and Holly keep quiet, letting him think it through. At last, he raises his head. I'm going to call it in. I don't want to, and if it was just between Hartsfield and me, I probably wouldn't. But I've got you two to consider. Don't do it on my account, Jerome says. If you see a way to go on, I'll stick with you. Of course you will, Hodges thinks. You might think you know what you're risking, but you don't. When you're 17, the future is strictly theoretical. As for Holly, previously he would have said she was a kind of human movie screen, with every thought in her head projected large on her face. But at this moment, she's inscrutable. Thanks, Jerome, only this is hard. Letting go is hard. And this will be the second time he has to relinquish Mr. Mercedes. But it's not just us, see? He could have more explosive, and if he uses it on a crowd... He looks directly at Holly. The way he used your cousin Olivia's Mercedes on a crowd, it would be on me. I won't take that chance. Speaking carefully, enunciating each word as if to make up for what has probably been a lifetime of mumbling, Holly says...
No one can catch him but you.
Thanks, but no, he says gently. The police have resources. They'll start by putting a bolo out on his car, complete with license plate number. I can't do that. It sounds good, but he doesn't believe it is good. When he's not taking insane risks like the one he took at City Center, Brady's one of the smart ones. He will have stashed the car somewhere, maybe in a downtown parking lot, maybe in one of the airport parking lots, maybe in one of those endless mall parking lots. His ride is no Mercedes-Benz. It's an unobtrusive, shit-colored Subaru, and it won't be found today or tomorrow. They might still be looking for it next week, and if they do find it, Brady won't be anywhere near it.
No one but you, she insists. And only with us to help you.
Holly.
How can you give up?
She cries at him. She balls one hand into a fist and strikes herself in the middle of the forehead with it, leaving a red mark.
How can you? Janie liked you. She was even sort of your girlfriend. Now she's dead. Like the woman upstairs, both of them dead.
She goes to hit herself again and Jerome takes her hand. Don't, he says. Please don't hit yourself. It makes me feel terrible. Holly starts to cry. Jerome hugs her clumsily. He's black and she's white. He's 17 and she's in her 40s. But to Hodges,
Jerome looks like a father comforting his daughter after she came home from school and said no one invited her to the spring dance.
Hodges looks out at the small but neatly kept Hartsfield backyard. He also feels terrible, and not just on Janie's account, although that is bad enough. He feels terrible for the people at City Center. He feels terrible for Janie's sister, whom they refused to believe, who was reviled in the press, and who was then driven to suicide by the man who lived in this house. He even feels terrible about his failure to pay heed to Mrs. Melbourne. He knows that Pete Huntley would let him off the hook on that one, and that makes it worse. Why? Because Pete isn't as good at this job as he, Hodges, still is. Pete never will be, not even on his best day. A good enough guy and a hard worker, but. All that changes nothing. He needs to call it in, even if it feels like dying. When you shove everything else aside, there's just one thing left. Kermit William Hodges is at a dead end. Brady Hartsfield is in the wind. There might be a lead in the computers, something to indicate where he is now, what his plans might be, or both, but Hodges can't access them. Nor can he justify continuing to withhold the name and description of the man who perpetrated the City Center massacre. Maybe Holly's right, maybe Brady Hartsfield will elude, capture, and commit some new atrocity, but Kermit Frog 19 is out of options. The only thing left for him to do is to protect Jerome and Holly if he can. At this point, he may not even be able to manage that. The nosy Parker across the street has seen them, after all. He steps out on the stoop and opens his Nokia, which he has used more today than in all the time since he retired. He thinks, doesn't this just suck? And speed dials Pete Huntley.
16. Pete picks up on the second ring.
Partner! He shouts exuberantly. There's a babble of voices in the background, and Hodges' first thought is that Pete's in a bar somewhere, half-shot and on his way to totally smashed.
Pete, I need to talk to you about...
Yeah, yeah, I'll eat all the crow you want, just not right now. Who calls you, Izzy?
Huntley, someone shouts. Chief's here in 5 with press. Where's the goddamn PIO?
PIO? Public Information Officer. Pete's not in a bar, not drunk, Hodges thinks. He's just over the moon fucking happy. No one called me, Pete. What's going on?
You don't know, Pete laughs. Just the biggest armaments bust in the city's history. Maybe the biggest in the history of the USA. Hundreds of M2 and HK-91 machine guns, rocket launchers, fucking laser cannons, crates of Lottie L-35s in mint condition, Russian AN-9 still in grease. There's enough stuff here to stock 2 dozen East European militias. And the ammo, Christ, it's stacked 2 stories high. If the fucking pawn shop had caught on fire, all of Lowtown would have gone up.
Sirens. He hears sirens. More shouts. Someone is bawling for someone else to get those sawhorses up. What pawn shop?
King Virtue Pawn and Loan, south of MLK. You know the place?
Yeah.
And guess who owns it?
But Pete is far too excited to give him a chance to guess.
Alonzo Moretti. Get it?
Hodges doesn't.
Moretti is Fabrizio Abbaschia's grandson, Bill. Fabby the Nose. Is it starting to come into focus now?
At first it still doesn't. Because when Pete and Isabel question him, Hodges simply plucked the Basquiat's name out of his mental file of old cases where someone might bear him animus. And there have been several hundred of those over the years. Pete, King Virtue's black-owned. All the businesses down there are.
The fuck it is. Baton Lawrence's name is on the sign, but the shop's a lease. Lawrence is a front and he's spilling his guts. You know the best part? We own part of the bus because a couple of patrol cops kicked it off a week or so before the ATF was going to roll these guys up. Every detective in the department is down here. The chief's on his way, and he's got a press caravan bigger than the Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade with him. No way the feds are going to hog this one. No way!
This time his laugh is positively loon-like. Every detective in the department, Hodges thinks, which leaves what for Mr. Mercedes? Bupkus is what?
Bill, I gotta go. This... man, this is amazing!
Sure, but first tell me what it has to do with me.
what you said. The car bomb was revenge. Moretti trying to pay off his grandfather's blood debt. In addition to the rifles, machine guns, grenades, pistols, and other assorted hardware, there's at least 4 dozen crates of Hendrix Chemicals data sheet. Do you know what that is?
Rubberized explosive. Now it's coming into focus.
Yeah. You set it off with lead azide detonators, and we know already that was the kind that was used to blow the stuff in your car. We haven't got a chem analysis on the explosive itself, but when we do, it'll turn out to be data sheet. You can count on it. You're one lucky old son of a bitch, Bill.
That's right, Hodges says. I am. He can picture the scene outside King Virtue, cops and ATF agents everywhere, probably arguing over jurisdiction already, and more coming all the time. Lowbrier closed off, probably MLK Avenue 2, crowds of looky-loos gathering. The chief of police and other assorted big boys on their way. The mayor won't miss the chance to make a speech. Plus all those reporters, TV crews, and live broadcast vans. Pete is bullshit with excitement, and as Hodge is going to launch into a long and complicated story about the city center massacre and a computer chat room called Debbie's Blue Umbrella and a dead mommy who probably drank herself to death and a fugitive computer repairman. No, he decides. I am not. What he does is wish Pete good luck and push end.
17.
When he comes back into the kitchen, Holly is no longer there, but he can hear her. Holly the mumbler has turned into Holly the revival preacher, it seems. Certainly her voice has that special good God almighty cadence, at least for the moment.
I'm with Mr. Hodges and his friend Jerome, she's saying. They're my friends, Mama. We had a nice lunch together. Now we're seeing some of the sights. And this evening, we're going to have a nice supper together. We're talking about Janie. I can do that if I want.
Even in his confusion over their current situation and his continuing sadness about Janie, Hodges is cheered by the sound of Holly standing up to Aunt Charlotte. He can't be sure it's for the first time, but by the living God it might be. Who called who? He asked Jerome, nodding toward her voice.
Holly made the call, but it was my idea. She had her phone turned off so her mother couldn't call her. She wouldn't do it until I said her mother might call the cops.
So what if I did, Holly is saying now. It was Olivia's car, and it's not like I stole it. I'll be back tonight, Mama. Until then, leave me alone.
She comes back into the room looking flushed, defiant, years younger, and actually pretty.
You rock, Holly. Jerome says and holds his hand up for a high five. She ignores this. Her eyes, still snapping, are fixed on Hodges.
If you call the police and I get in trouble, I don't care. But unless you already did, you shouldn't. They can't find him. We can. I know we can.
Hodges realizes that if catching Mr. Mercedes is more important to anyone on Earth than it is to him, that person is Holly Gibney. Maybe for the first time in her life she's doing something that matters, and doing it with others who like and respect her. I'm going to hold on to it a little longer, mostly because the cops are otherwise occupied this afternoon. The funny part, or maybe I mean the ironic part, is that they think it has to do with me.
What are you talking about? Jerome asks.
Hodges glances at his watch and sees it's 2:20. They have been here long enough. Let's go back to my place. I can tell you on the way, and then we can kick this around one more time. If we don't come up with anything, I'll have to call my partner back. I'm not risking another horror show. Although the risk is already there, and he can see by their faces that Jerome and Holly know it as well as he does.
I went in that little study beside the living room to call my mother, Holly says. Mrs. Hartsfield's got a laptop. If we're going to your house, I want to bring it.
Why?
I may be able to find out how to get into his computers. She might have written down the keyboard prompts or voice app password.
Holly, that doesn't seem likely. Mentally ill guys like Brady go to great lengths to hide what they are from everyone.
I know that, Holly says. Of course I do, because I'm mentally ill, and I try to hide it.
Hey, Hal, come on. Jerome tries to take her hand. She won't let him.
She takes her cigarettes from her pocket instead.
I am, and I know I am. My mother knows too, and she keeps an eye on me. She snoops on me, because she wants to protect me. Mrs. Hartsfield will have been the same. He was her son, after all.
If the Linkletter woman at Discount Electronics was right, Hodges says, Mrs. Hartsfield would have been drunk on her ass a good deal of the time. Holly replies,
she could have been a high-functioning drunk. Have you got a better idea?
Hodges gives up. Okay, take the laptop. What the hell?
Not yet, she says. In 5 minutes. I want to smoke a cigarette. I'll go out on the stoop.
She goes out. She sits down. She lights up. Through the screen door, Hodges calls.
When did you become so assertive, Holly?
She doesn't turn around to answer.
I guess when I saw pieces of my cousin burning in the street.
18. At 2:45 that afternoon, Brady leaves his Motel 6 room for a breath of fresh air and spies a chicken coop on the other side of the highway. He crosses and orders his last meal, a Clucker Delight with extra gravy and coleslaw. The restaurant section is almost deserted, and he takes his tray to a table by the windows so he can sit in the sunshine. Soon there will be no more of that for him, so he might as well enjoy a little while he still can. He eats slowly, thinking of all the times he brought home takeout from the chicken coop, and how his mother always asked for a clucker with double slaw. He has ordered her meal without even thinking about it. This brings tears, and he wipes them away with a paper napkin. Poor mom. Sunshine is nice, but its benefits are ephemeral. Brady considers the more lasting benefits darkness will provide. No more listening to Freddie Linklater's lesbo-feminist rants. No more listening to Tones Frobisher explain why he can't go out on service calls because of his responsibility to the store, when it's really because he wouldn't know a hard drive crash if it bit him on the dick. No more feeling his kidneys turning to ice as he drives around in the Mr. Tasty truck in August with the freezers on high. No more whapping the Subaru's dashboard when the radio cuts out. No more thinking about his mother's lacy panties and long, long thighs. No more fury at being ignored and taken for granted. No more headaches. And no more sleepless nights, because after today it will be all sleep, all the time, with no dreams. When he's finished his meal, he eats every bite. Brady busses his table, wipes up a splatter of gravy with another napkin, and dumps his trash. The girl at the counter asks him if everything was all right. Brady says it was, wondering how much of the chicken and gravy and biscuits and coleslaw will have a chance to digest before the explosion rips his stomach open and sprays what's left everywhere. They'll remember me, he thinks, as he stands at the edge of the highway, waiting for a break in traffic so he can go back to the motel. Highest score ever. I'll go down in history. He's glad now that he didn't kill the fat ex-cop. Hodges should be alive for what's coming tonight. He should have to remember. He should have to live with it. Back in the room, he looks at the wheelchair and the explosive-stuffed urine bag lying on the explosive-stuffed ass parking cushion. He wants to get to the Mac early, but not too early. The last thing he wants is to stand out more than he will just by being male and older than 13. But there's still a little time. He's brought his laptop, not for any particular reason, but just out of habit, and now he's glad. He opens it, connects to the motel's Wi-Fi, and goes to Debbie's blue umbrella. There, he leaves one final message, a kind of insurance policy. With that attended to, he walks back to the airport's long-term parking lot and retrieves his Subaru.
19. Hodges and his two apprentice detectives arrive on Harper Road shortly before 3:30. Holly shoots a cursory glance around, then totes the late Mrs. Hartsfield's laptop into the kitchen and powers it up. Jerome and Hodges stand by, both hoping there will be no password screen, but there is.
Try her name, Jerome says.
Holly does. The Mac shakes its screen. No.